This is Album Worms. It's like a book club, but for albums. I'm your host, Sean, and on this episode, we will be discussing Carole King's album, Tapestry. Let's get started. Welcome to Album Worms. Welcome to another episode of Album Worms. Please take a moment and follow us on your favorite podcasting platform and follow us on Instagram at Album Worms. On our last episode, we had a little bit of technical difficulties with getting Chris's audio to work. So that set us back a little bit. So I went ahead and still wanted to listen to an album, even though Chris wasn't available at the moment. And I was talking with my wife, Jordy. When I first started this podcast, she really wanted to talk about Carole King's album, Tapestry. So what better time than now to welcome back my boo?
Hey.
You're our first returning guest on Album Wars.
Oh my goodness, yeah. Wow. It's a distinguished honor.
So if you didn't hear the last episode Jordy was on, you could go back and listen to our Fleet Foxes Shore episode. Jordy was on that episode. Well, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for buying me this album for my birthday.
She's holding the album.
Literally holding the physical vinyl album that he bought me for my birthday. And I just feel like it's going to give me all the right vibes to rightfully discuss this great work of art.
I do have some thoughts about the actual vinyl of this. So I guess before we get into our discussion, should we listen to a clip to get us in a mood?
Absolutely.
All right. Let it listen to the lead track. This is I Feel the Earth Move.
Rips.
It sure does. That's a heck of a way to start an album.
I love it when albums start that way. Like, do not hold back. Just really let it rip. And she wrote and created the music for that album, which you don't see as much these days. So,
well, as what I'm sure we'll talk about, she was writing music for other people's albums well long before she was writing this record. And some of those songs actually showed up on this record, too.
I know. And so I kind of want to talk about that, too, about, you know, I had a chicken and an egg situation where I'm like, okay, I recognize this song, but did she perform it first and then someone else used it, or vice versa? So I'm sure we'll get into that when the time comes. I don't want to jump ahead. I know that there's a method and a process we have to organically go through to properly exposit this.
Well, we're going to be a little bit more free-flowing today.
I'm
so
loosey-goosey.
We'll see how it goes. But I guess we should go through the album details because that makes sense. So this album was released on February 10th, 1971. It's the 81st best-selling album of all time, with over 14 million sales certified worldwide, reaching diamond status in 1995.
What do you have to do to reach diamond status?
That's a good question.
Diamonds.
I mean, it's so many million.
It's a big deal. We don't know how big, but it's a big deal.
I know it's millions. Which
I mean, and the fact that she's in the top 100 of all time. I mean, think how many albums have been created. She's in my top 100, that's for sure.
10 million.
Okay. 10 million copies sold is diamond. Excellent. Well, certified diamond, that's better than gold, I'm guessing.
Yes. There's platinum in between there too, I think.
Okay, so that's about as big as it gets.
Yeah, I think platinum's got to be in there somewhere, I don't know.
Well, I've heard platinum, I've heard double platinum.
It looks like there's only 92 albums diamond certified.
Oh, wow. Elvis Presley's Christmas album.
Yeah, see here, gold, platinum, diamond.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm just learning as we go. Bless you.
It received 4 Grammy Awards in 1972, including Album of the Year, and the lead singles from the album, It's Too Late and I Feel the Earth Move, spent 5 weeks at number 1 on both the Billboard Hot 100 and Easy Listening charts.
Ooh, is there still an Easy Listening chart?
There's gotta be.
I really... coast. It's a beautiful day here on the coast. Is that elevator?
Is Coast still around?
Even? Oh, yeah, Coast 103.5.
Does anybody listen to the radio?
Especially in the pandemic. I do in my older, I do because my car is older, but I know especially in the pandemic, it's got to be not so good. Coast turns into a Christmas station in about, I don't know, October 1st or something like that. And they have an incredible talent for picking the absolute worst Christmas songs, like the worst 10 to 12, and then just playing them on a loop for 3 months.
And I will take those worst Christmas songs in October just to get me through that month because I'm not a fan.
You're not an October guy? What don't you like about October?
Well, here it's just too hot, and then everybody puts up their creepy decorations, and it's just not. And then also, it's also all the spiders and bugs come out that time of year, too.
It gets very spidery.
Yeah. No, thank you.
Hard pass. You don't get out your boots and scarves and pumpkin spice lattes. And
not when it's still 90 degrees out.
Like 90 degrees and hot Santa Ana winds.
Yeah.
And people are trying to make a hot latte work. We enjoy making fun of them every year, though, don't we? Is that what gets us through, is mocking people?
I have to think about it. I'll have to do.
He's either like kvetching or mocking in the month of October. It's how he copes. Wait, did I send you that meme last October? It was like one leaf falls and it turns into Han Solo season.
What's that?
One leaf falls and it turns into Han Solo season. Everyone's wearing like a vest and knee-high boots. There's an expletive in there too, but I know this is a family show.
Another interesting part of Tapestry and the kind of record-breaking status it had, it sat in the number one spot for 15 consecutive weeks and remained on the charts for nearly 6 years. And this is actually saying that it has sold over 25 million copies now worldwide. So the 14 million copies, I don't know if that...
That's 2.5 times diamond, yeah. Sean.
I don't know when the 14 million, I don't know what that was about.
Oh, well, it's certified worldwide, where the other one is copies worldwide. Oh, okay. I don't know. There's got to be... There's a bureaucracy involved. Yeah.
They sold a lot of copies. So it's...
What we're trying to say is it did really well, and it's good.
It did well. So there's some, I guess there's also the difference is there's some albums that didn't do well when they were released. Like, I don't know if you know this, but like Wilco's Yankee Foxtrot Hotel did not do well when it first came out. And then it gradually built momentum over time and then became this huge album like several years later.
That's so interesting. I had no idea.
But this was like
the world wasn't ready
gate.
For it.
Yeah, exactly.
They were ahead of their time. The world wasn't ready for it. It's like Napoleon Dynamite. The first few times I watched it, I was like, this is weird. Like, I was not prepared.
I liked it better the first few times I watched it.
Okay. Well, yeah. I was like 16, so 16 or 17. And
yeah,
I
was
like, I don't get this. I was used to Mean Girls. I had never seen anything like it. And then it just really grew on me. So now it's classic.
It did that whole roller coaster where it was like, this is weird, I don't know what it is, this is awesome, then it went back down, this is really too much, and now I think it's maybe plateaued. It's okay. It was good for the time.
Just so
I don't know, I haven't watched it in a long time. I probably would like it.
You need to see how it aged, John. I think it aged just fine, like a fine wine.
The Tina, you fat lard.
Tina, Tina.
That aged well. That still plays.
That's what you wanted me to name Linda, is Tina.
Tina, fat lard. She is a fat
yeah,
lard.
Yeah, our guinea pig Linda is a fatty. She actually just ate a piece of my necklace I was wearing. It's still rattling around in her mouth. I can't get her to spit it out. So, yeah, she's like a fluffy jelly bean is kind of her general shape.
So, interesting enough about, so a little bit about Carol King's history or origin story, if you will.
I will.
Carol King wrote all the songs or co-wrote all the songs. So there's a few songs on this album that were from her songwriting days. So early or before she released her solo records, she was a songwriter with her husband. They were a writing pair. Mm-hmm. And they wrote some big hits for Aretha Franklin, which is on this record, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. That was released in 1967. And then the one that really kind of set the pace for them was the Shirley's and Will You Love Me Tomorrow, which is also on this record. That was released in 1960. And that 1960 song, or when that song became a hit, that is when Carole King and her husband quit their day jobs and started focusing on songwriting full time.
Well, if you think about it, that if she was born in 1942, and that song went crazy, that I think it's Shirelles, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, in 1960. So she was 18. And I know that her and her first husband wrote that, and they had just had their first baby the year before when she was 17. And she was just like, I had a baby on one hip and a pen in the other hand, and she just kept pursuing her dreams, which I love. A lot of people think that having a baby is maybe the end of their dreams, and she just kept plugging away with that baby on her hip. She was a real earth mother. They lived in like a artist's commune for songwriters, and it's just all of it is just impossibly groovy and awesome. So yeah, that when they went big was like, what was she, like 18 years old?
Yeah, she was really young, and also got married and had kids really young as well.
Bless her.
Yeah. Interesting enough though, right when this album was coming out is when her and her husband split, or a little bit before that. She also was, before she released her solo records, she was in a band, a brief band called The City. Did you know this?
I had read a little bit about The City, yes.
Yeah.
But I don't want to steal your thunder by sharing any facts that I know about
There's not too many facts besides that she had a band. That
my understanding is that they had a hard time performing because she had terrible stage fright.
Correct.
So that makes for, it's awkward when you're in a band and you can't do shows because you have awful stage fright. So I thought that was pretty interesting that she has this incredible talent, basically just from a super young age, but no real desire or ability to be ultra famous and do massive shows.
Yeah. And so the story goes, James Taylor is the one that really helped her get over some of that stage fright, or to continue to help her with continuing on with her solo career.
Do you think that James Taylor could help you through some stuff? Because I feel like he could probably, I feel like he could probably coach me through some things.
I think
as
James
well.
Taylor has helped millions of people.
People he doesn't even know.
Exactly. Do you, so without looking at my list, Jordy.
Okay, I'm not looking at your list, Sean.
So before she became, or I guess just over time, do you know some of the artists that Carol King has written songs for?
I don't. I have no idea. I'm seriously just familiar with this album.
Okay.
And it's a huge, I mean, we can talk about that more later, but this album is like stitched into the tapestry of my life, if you will. And so, no, I have no idea. Wow me.
So there are a lot. So I'm only going to mention a few. And if you're really interested, you can go Wikipedia and have a day. But here's just a few, because these are pretty big. The Beatles.
Oh, just them? heard of them?
Which the Beatles kind of... That one was a little... She didn't write that song for the Beatles. She wrote a song for someone else. They recorded it, and the Beatles made a cover of that song. But nonetheless. So there's Donny Osmond. This is a throwback. The Monkees. Blood, Sweat, and Tears, The Byrds, Dusty Springfield, James Taylor, and a little bit more recent, I think this was in the 90s, Just For You, Mariah Carey.
Oh, 90s Mariah. I need to look up what song.
But there is someone even more famous than all of them that performed one of her songs. Do you know who that is? Or should I just play a clip?
Just play a clip.
Oh, what the heck? Once more from the top.
Yay! When the jazz man's testifying, the faithless man.
It's Bleeding Gums Murphy. Oh, accompanying yeah. Lisa Simpson. Is it jazz band or jazz man testifying?
Jazz man.
Okay. I always thought it was jazz band. That's how I sang it all growing up.
It was a tribute to the jazz man, Bleeding Gums Murphy.
Well, you know, that didn't make sense in young Jordy's mind.
Oh, man. Yeah, that might be her the best Carole King cover. Okay. Sorry, Aretha and Beatles.
We're giving it to Lisa Simpson and her really pitchy voice. Oh, my gosh.
A little bit more about this album in particular. So we talked about James Taylor really helped Carole King. Mm-hmm. So I think them meeting right before her first solo album, which was in the 70s, was big. She also met Joni Mitchell, which there was a bunch of all these people kind of recording all in the same area. So James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, I think the Carpenters even were around that. And I think, I want to say Carole King might have written a song for Carpenters, but I'm 100% on that too. But James Taylor and Joni Mitchell both were on this record with Carole King on Tapestry. They did backup vocals and guitar, or James Taylor did guitar at least, and Joni Mitchell did backup vocals.
Very cool.
But her first solo album, Rider, which was released in 1970, wasn't a big hit. It didn't really take off, which is interesting because this became such a big hit. So I think that we'll bookmark that one. But another interesting fact is during this time, Carole King played keyboards for B.B. King's album, Indianola, Mississippi Seeds.
Is it like a mix between Indiana and New Orleans? Indianola?
I don't know.
That's another discussion for another day.
Yeah. But if you're playing keys for B.B. King, you're pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say so.
So I'm interested, so getting into kind of more of our questions or discussion, why is this record so important to you, or why have you attached to this record?
Personally?
Yeah.
So this album is something that we listened to a lot growing up, and it was always such a great way to kick off road trips with earth moving under your feet. Or we just have it kind of blazing in the house while my dad cooked. I know my dad would always tell me that my grandma would crank it when she cleaned her house. So every time I listen to it, I can just picture her raking her shag carpet and listening to this when this album first came out, probably, or all through the 70s. She was, you know, waxing the linoleum and raking the shag, listening to this album. So I feel like it just really connects me to my family. All the songs are so pure. So we can kind of get into how the nature of the songs and the music played into that time in American history. But for me, it's got a little bit of everything. And I can't listen to it without having a bunch of happy memories and just feeling like it really encapsulates the essence of my family culture and is kind of just like a reflection of my personality. So when you got me this album for my birthday, it was really sweet.
So you talked about, or why, what was the thing that you want to talk more about?
Just kind of where this song fit within, I think part of the reason this album was so successful in its time, 1971, correct, when this album came out, is because it was such a tumultuous time, kind of like what we have going now in American politics and culture, and the album is so simple and sweet and straightforward. It talks about love and home and, you know, just dreaming, and I just think that it has sweet sentimental songs. It has songs that really rock, has songs that people were familiar with, but they got to hear a new take on songs that she had written, you know, years before for other artists. So I think it just hit a sweet spot in that tumultuous time and gave people, it was like a solid foundation, something that, and it has so much soul. So I feel like it appeals to such a wide variety of listeners is because it's simple, but it has so much soul that you can't not like it. And if you don't like it, I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah, I wouldn't have taken the same approach as why it was successful, but I definitely see that point, and I agree with the positivity and the time that it was raised, because I would have gone straight to the familiarity, because it kind of already plays like a greatest hits record, mm-hmm. because people are already familiar with it. And then you pair in just Carol's talent, because it wouldn't have worked if you, even if you wrote the song for Aretha Franklin, if you don't got pipes like to compare to Aretha, like it's not gonna play well. Even if you were the original songwriter. So when she came out with this, and I think especially in that first track, I Feel the Earth Move, that her pipes, but across the album, her singing voice is just so captivating. And I think that probably gained a lot of respect from listeners that she was behind the shadows when she had all this talent for all those years.
Makes me think of Phyllis on The Office, who was just a casting director.
Oh, yeah.
And then ended up on the main cast somehow. I mean, I know there's a longer story there.
But, and that's her real name, too.
And her name is Phyllis, and she was
doing different last names.
She was doing casting for the show, and now she's had, you know, a career as a voice actress and doing other things. And it's great when the people who are doing the work behind the scenes can actually do the work. So it's not just someone telling you, oh, this is how the song goes. Like, she can actually sing it, and quite well. And like you said, to be following an act like Aretha Franklin singing that song, you have to have major chops. Doesn't matter if she wrote it or not. Like, I don't need to hear Heartbreaker, Mariah Carey's Heartbreaker, by whoever wrote the song. I don't need to hear that. I don't think anyone was wondering, like, oh, I wonder what the white lady who wrote this song sounds like. I think they were pretty satisfied with Aretha, but she went for it. And you can tell that song is her baby. When she's singing it, you can tell when she's singing these songs that she wrote for other people. Because even You've Got a Friend, that number one hit for James Taylor, the way she sings it, it's totally hers. And you can tell that there's a lot of love that went into crafting that song and that music.
That is also interesting, that song that you just mentioned, because You've Got a Friend was recorded by James Taylor, but only like a month apart, or like it was really close to when this record came out. They both put on their records that same year.
I love that. It's low drama. It's like, I'll have my version, you'll have your version. Like, you can tell they just lived in this commune of artistry. Like, yeah, we'll just both have it. And if you have great success with it, that's great for you. And I'm going to sing it from my heart. And it's just all so groovy. I love that. Nothing but love.
Yeah. And we mentioned before, James Taylor shows up on this record too. So when I was re-listening to it, even Will You Love Me Tomorrow, I was like, oh man, this plays a lot like a James Taylor song, and he's playing guitar and singing backup vocals on it.
He's literally playing it. That's why he's like, oh yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, he's all over this. I'm looking at the back of the album cover.
Yeah. So I guess when you were talking about like success, or why do you think this album was a success too? I think there's some components of this record that we haven't yet kind of talked about, like the foundation of it, the how it was structured. So do you have any thoughts on that? And or why do you think this record was a huge success when her first record wasn't?
I don't know. I haven't heard her first record. And it could be one of those things like you were talking about where the world wasn't ready for it.
Right.
So, you know, just like Wilco had when we were discussing earlier, I think that without having heard it, I have no idea. But I think that starting this album out with I Feel the Earth Move, it really grabs your attention. And I feel like it gives her so much credibility. Whereas before you would have been like, oh, this is just okay compared to these other folk artists that I like. I mean, that song Earth Move, it's folk and it's rock. And it totally grabs you. And then you're just in for the rest of it. You're along for the rest of the ride.
Yes.
There's only one song on this album that I'm like, meh, meh. And I'm not even, yeah. But otherwise.
What's the song?
Smackwater Jack.
Oh, you don't like Smackwater Jack?
Maybe. I mean, it doesn't.
It
just doesn't do as much for me. I don't dislike it. It just doesn't do, like every other song, it like does a lot for me. Smackwater Jack and Tapestry are both kind of like the B-sides to me. Do you agree?
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that at all, because those two songs are nothing like the rest of the album, because mm-hmm. they're actually more folk songs.
Very much so, yeah.
And the rest of the album is singer-songwriter.
That makes sense. Yeah, they kind of are more storytelling
right.
songs, yeah.
Which, I mean, it can throw some people off. Because if you're thinking, especially when that's considering like start to finish, listen to the record from start to finish, and you're getting like all these very personal singer-songwriter songs, and then you get Smackwater Jack, and it kind of takes you out of it maybe if you're paying attention to the lyrics.
Yeah, I mean, the other ones are like kind of these really great sing-alongs, whereas as this, it more tells a story like a folk song, which I, now that I think of it that way, I feel like I'll be able to approach it from a different point. So this is why I listen to Album Worms. You know, who loves folk songs that tell a story is our youngest. He wants to listen to Mariner's Revenge song.
Oh, yeah.
Several times a day. And he just loves the whole story, even though it's quite violent.
That's why he probably likes it.
Yikes. Yeah, so he would probably like Smackwater Jack. I'm reading these lyrics, and I'm like, oh, this is so him. His middle name is Wilco. Maybe that's why.
So you're holding the record. So there is another interesting fact about why this album was a success, or just an interesting thing about this time of when the album was released, because you don't think of this at all today. And that is, what song is starting side A versus what song is starting side B? And I think this is one of those records that's like the gold standard for having hits on side A and side B. So it was I Feel the Earth Move on side A, and then I believe it was You've Got a Friend, or what?
Yeah, You've Got a Friend starts off side two.
And those were both big hits. I think they called it two side A's. When you did that.
That's a strong album. You got enough good material for two side A's.
So, I mean, you don't really think about that in today's streaming world of music.
No, because so much of what we listen to is playlists, which is, you know, just you pull your favorites from every album, which, I mean, why this podcast exists is to bring back the art of listening to an album backwards and forwards. And I've already learned so much just you pointing out those two songs being more folk songs and the other ones being singer-songwriter, and that's why it takes you out of it. I almost wonder if they should have been put at the bottom. Definitely,
Tapestry.
Yeah, I feel like those two songs should have been the last two instead of, because then right after that comes You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, like that little ditty. So I feel like maybe that should have sent a rearrange in the lineup. But it, clearly it did not affect the success of the album, and no one cares about my input 50 years later. It's been 50 years, Sean.
I know.
50th sure anniversary. Has. Wow. I just realized that. Is that why we're doing this album? Because it's been 50 years?
Yeah, let's just say it is. Exactly the reason why we're doing this record.
Yes.
But I want to bring back the concept of two side A's.
Okay.
I want to...
make it a thing.
Yeah.
See what you can do.
So, musically on this record, there's a few things that stood out to me, and I'll go into some specifics, but to kind of kick us off, to me, there's a triad of what made this album tick.
Okay.
That was, so I guess, taking out a Carole King's vocals, so obviously that is the main reason why.
That's the bread and butter of the album.
That's the bread and the butter. But really, besides her vocal work, her piano work, so Carole King is playing piano, is just all the piano work on this record is so good. And then the bass lines on this record are amazing. So good, so groovy, so very kind of jazz oriented. And then the backup vocals also were really phenomenal. And backup vocals, so sometimes it really helps a song, but a lot of times it just helps with kind of layers. But I feel this one really stood out to me as really assisting the record. So I think they get a call out for really being pulling this record together.
Amen. It's interesting because her voice can be so soft, like a lullaby. And then, I mean, are we supposed to talk about her voice some more? I'm going to do it. And then it can also be like so powerful and soulful. So she has such range in that way of what she can do with her voice and what emotions she can evoke with it. And then her piano playing, same thing. It can be really light and just like nice, relaxing spa music, or it can just be heavy rock piano, where you can tell she's putting her whole body into it. And if she, I don't think I've ever watched a live performance of hers. I've just listened to this album, but it's the kind of thing where you can picture her standing as she plays. Yeah, be like, stand up. I'm picturing like Elton John, but I don't know if she actually ever did that, but it's, you know, you got to put some, at least your upper body into it when you're playing that hard, and probably your lower body too with the pedals. So,
Are you speaking specifically of I Feel the Earth Move?
No, I'm talking about the whole thing. Yeah, even parts in Beautiful, a song that's very sweet. You know, it goes from being this sweet thing about wondering about the world, watching the world pass by, wondering how you're going to get through another day, and then just, you've got to get up. I'm not going to try to sing it, but
I pulled that clip for this song in anticipation of this. I knew that you were going to attempt to sing it, so I was like, I'm going to help.
I will sing it off air. You know I love to sing Carole King at the top of my voice. Did you hear that in your meeting earlier today or maybe yesterday?
No, I did not.
I was putting away laundry right next to your office, and I had my AirPods in. I was singing to this album, and I was like, oh, Sean's microphone might be on. That's okay. They're going to learn one sooner or later about me and my singing around the house.
So I pulled a clip for this because I think, take note of, I think this is just real unique. I haven't heard it at all, really. Like how she enters the song and just kicks it off.
You got to get up every morning with a smile on your face and show the world all the love in your heart. Then people gonna treat you better. You're gonna find, yes, you will.
I really love that intro.
She just gets right down to it.
I mean, that it's not really like that simple to like hit one and then like on the offbeat her vocals start.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty It's pretty fascinating. That intro, also the like the melody or the riff that she's playing at the beginning, also kind of reminded me of the Beatles a bit. That song.
Mm-hmm. Something about this music, I'm telling you, is that babies love it. That's another part of why this album is so special. I'd have the boys on the floor and be like, I would almost be like listening to, especially I feel the earth move, like tapping the floor to the beat, and they would just be transfixed. And if our babies, if we weren't holding them, were kind of fussy. So for them to just be kind of happy and tripping out on something, it was this music. And so Brandon Hardy, who was a guest on your Phoebe Bridgers episode, he does this awesome thing where he has different morning music for his baby. This baby is so cute. He looks like a small man. I die. But I recommended this album for his baby's floor time, and he did it. And I'm just telling you, babies love it. They can feel it too. They feel the soul. They feel the music. That it's so pure that even a baby loves it.
Yep. It's got good vibes.
Good vibes.
So something else that stood out to me, which I don't know if this caught your attention or not. So I feel the earth move. You're talking about her vocals. Her vocals on that song are insane.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are certain parts where you would normally take a breath as a singer, and she doesn't. She actually like drops an octave and then keeps going.
Who needs air?
Yeah.
Who needs... It's just like when you got a voice like that, who? Why bother with air? You just keep going.
Yeah, that part was, as always, every time I listened to that, I was like, I don't know how she had enough breath to do that.
I don't know. You hear people sing like that and you think they can probably hold their breath underwater for a super long time. Like their lungs and their diaphragm are like so stretched out and strong from singing like that over and over again. And you know that they are doing it right. You can hear in their voice that they're doing it right and that they're not going to end up with like a vocal cord injury. I feel like I can tell those people that are going to...
Oh, yeah.
Like, they like have Adele. A really... Yeah, like Adele. I think even Mariah Carey has had vocal cord injuries. It's like they've... You can tell that they're working really hard and it sounds great. But for Carole King, it sounds almost effortless. Like, so powerful, but effortless. And as far as I know, she hasn't damaged her vocal cords in the 50 years hence. But, you know, maybe.
Yeah. She also...
I haven't checked her medical records.
Yeah, get some... We'll report back on that one.
Yeah, we need to get an investigative reporter intern. When are you getting an intern, Sean?
Well, we'll put out the call at the end of the episode.
Unpaid, no academic credit. Maybe not legal.
Questionable ethics.
No cursing allowed.
So I think this record also was really jazzy to me. Like even like Way Over Yonder, I felt like when I was listening to it, I picture myself in a jazz club and it was just like Carole up there and just a few like a trio of artists playing and enjoying an evening, which is... Since I was probably in high school, what I felt was probably like the pinnacle of cool.
Would be that's like just peak cool.
Being in a jazz club and just chilling.
Do you mean watching or playing?
Probably owning and being somewhat mob-like.
Gold chains.
Yeah.
I can see that, Sean. I feel like, I don't know, one day I can see this. What, you could call the jazz club Album Worms, and even if there's not live music, you just sit around listening to albums, just feeling it.
There we go.
Craft beer.
Well, there is. So there is some interesting. So there is. Do you notice what song Flute made an appearance on?
I can't remember.
So there's a little flute solo on So Far Away and a nice little sax solo on Way Over Yonder, which I think maybe contributed to that jazz feel. But there was also, before we move on maybe to talk more about lyrics, there was one song, It's Too Late, where the piano riff, I was like, this sounds so much like something. So I pulled the clip because it sound, and I thought of it almost right away because it sounded exactly like Chicago's Saturday in the Park. So listen to these two clips. So first we'll listen to It's Too Late by Carole King.
One of us is changing, or maybe we've just stopped trying. And it's too late, baby, now it's too late. Though we really...
All right, so now here's Chicago.
Dancing, people laughing, a man selling ice cream, singing Italian songs.
If you hadn't wagged your finger at exactly the right part of where the similarity was, I don't know if I would have caught it. I think that's maybe something that you have to, the common folk wouldn't notice.
It's just the same, like, so the notes and the songs are different, but it's the same exact rhythm. The like, dun, 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 dun.
You're good at this, honey. I would have never heard it. Again, even if you showed me those two clips, I still didn't hear it except you pointed your finger at exactly the right part, so then I kind of heard it. So that's like a deep cut. Exactly, that's the word I was looking for.
Over your head. I shouldn't have brought it up type.
No, I mean, you should have brought it up. Over my head, yes. Should have brought it up, yes, absolutely. Just because it's over my head doesn't mean that it's not a really good observation.
Well, do you want to talk about lyrics, anything?
I do want to talk about lyrics. I really do. You know I love lyrics. Lyrics are, you know, 75% of, probably a good 60% of my enjoyment of an album.
That's mind-blowing to me. Like, I can't comprehend because lyrics almost are meaningless to me.
I'm a writer and I'm a talker and I don't like stupid lyrics. I don't like pointless lyrics. I don't like obscene lyrics. And especially,
I'm just over here with my glasses going, hey, do you hear the same difference in this riff in Chicago?
Yeah, I'm like, great. Okay, great. I think this is such a huge part of being a singer-songwriter and folk music is the lyrics. And I mean, just starting out, there's her real name. King is a name that she chose for herself, Carole King. Her real name's Carole Klein, and she was raised Jewish. And she raised her daughters in the Jewish faith and the Jewish traditions. And in Way Over Yonder, I saw some mention. Some of the lyrics had some Old Testament things. So much of the song is similar imagery and sounds like the description of the Promised Land. And specifically, to the land where the honey runs in rivers each day, God promised the Israelites that they would find a land flowing with milk and honey. So as I'm listening to the song, I heard the honey the first time. I've always heard the honey in there, which immediately gives me that Old Testament imagery of the Promised Land. But then if you listen to the song again and have that, I don't know if that was her intention with the song, but you can definitely see her her Jewish tradition and her knowledge influencing the imagery in this song, where you can find peace of mind, a garden of wisdom, basically the good life, which is what God had promised to the Israelites. So I enjoyed that aspect of the song on top of it just being super soulful, as we discussed earlier. The song Beautiful, totally inspiring. I mean, if you wake up grumpy like I do a lot of times, a song like that, get up every morning with a smile on your face, show the world all the love in your heart. And what I love about that song is it says, you're as beautiful as you feel. So it's not talking about get up every morning and, you know, get dressed and do your hair. But it's about how beautiful you feel and how the world will see that through your smile and through the way that you let your light shine of treating others with kindness. So I find that song super inspiring, even on a day, which is a lot of days where I just wake up looking and feeling kind of junky.
I would say I would challenge anybody to listen to that song Beautiful and not feel a little bit better.
I absolutely. That's like part of the reason I think this album did so well is because it just, it's not so many of the albums that come out today. It's like about bad situations. It's about, you know, partying, stuff like that. That's not like in your day to day, really reflective of your day to day life or helpful in your day to day life. And that doesn't mean that this song is by any means like syrupy or surface level. It's an incredibly deep album and a deep song, but it's encouraging for that day-to-day stuff. I mean, I know that this might be controversial, but I love the Where You Lead song.
I do have a question for that, but yeah, I'll save it for a little bit.
I love Where You Lead. I mean, it makes me think of us. I'm like, anywhere you go, I'll follow. I'll go anywhere. Sometimes I wish you would go somewhere so I could follow you. Sean's a homebody, so it's not that hard to follow him. But even if, you know, in the different changes over the course of our, 15-year relationship, I've just been all in.
So before, I want to circle back to that, but before we do, I want to point out something that, obviously I agree and wholeheartedly with everything you're saying with the lyrics that you pointed out, but did you notice across any trends across any of the songs?
No, but I have a feeling you did.
Yeah, there's one thing.
I'm not gonna try to guess.
In the "I Feel the Earth Move," there was a lyric that said, "And you tenderly call my name," and "You've Got a Friend," there was, "You just call out my name." And then in "Where You Lead," there was a lyric, "All you have to do is call my name." So she has something about calling my name across three different songs.
Sean! That's me. I call your name all across the house. And then when you don't hear me, I call you, even though you're upstairs. Or I text you. So it's good to know that. Are you saying that I can call you by your name? Is that what you're doing?
No, I know
what you're doing. I'm just messing with you. That is a really great observation. I did not notice that, and you're absolutely right. And those are all very obvious lyrics, so I should have noticed that. But, you know.
Well, especially with "You've Got a Friend" and "Where You Lead," made me look at it because those songs were back to back. So I heard on Where You Lead, I was, didn't she just say call my name on the last song?
Do you think she was running out of material, or do you think she was trying to weave a tapestry?
I think it was. I don't know about the "I Feel the Earth Move," but I feel "Where You Lead" is definitely, I would wager that it was a reference to her previous song. Because I don't think you put those lyrics back to back if you didn't want people to notice that there was a connection. Her lyrics flowed in this song too. Winter, spring, summer, and fall, all you have to do is call. Those are kind of like written on paper, or just saying it is kind of bland and almost like elementary.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds so good in the song. It catches your attention and it's like super endearing.
I know. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I'm looking at the notes here, and it says winter, spring, summer, fall, and I'm like, yep, those are all the seasons. But the way that she weaves it all together with the music, it makes it so singable. It's not a bad thing to have simple lyrics as long as they're not vapid.
Yeah.
So even though the words is simple, the sentiment isn't.
Yeah. All right, so let's go political here for a second. We'll give Big Brown Army a shout out because you do talk politics on the Big Brown Army podcast with the Cruz on their weekly update, and you did great. So definitely check out Jordy on that podcast.
Thank you.
And DeCruz does great as well. So he definitely check out that podcast if you're interested in politics. They do great coverage. And bringing that back to here, Where You Lead is maybe controversial in this era. So how do you feel it plays in this era, or what is your take on that song now? I know you said that you still like it, but
I mean, the song, it says, where you lead, I'll follow, anywhere that you tell me to, I need to be with you. I mean, I don't think that that is out of the realm of how people feel about each other still. I know it's unpopular in terms of how we raise girls nowadays to, we raise them to be more independent, and I think that's great too. I think Lana Del Rey has run into this kind of issue where people, you know, they criticize her lyrics and her songs because they portray what critics perceive to be as unhealthy attachments to men or unhealthy relationships. And she's like, hey, I don't know what to tell you. These are my songs. These are my experiences. And she has every right to express her experiences and her feelings and her kind of just dive into her relationships and express them musically. And so she's defended her right to do that, even though people say, well, you're giving, you know, young women the wrong idea about relationships. And I mean, it's up to each of us to raise our girls to be independent and to be wise. But if you've found the right person like I have, I see it's a great honor to be able to follow them. So, I think it's just all in how you view it.
I think there, if this song came out today, I think there would be some backlash.
Yeah, I mean, remember that song in the 90s, that Cardigan song, love me, say that to love me, go on and use me. I remember just like singing that song to myself and my dad being like, no, like don't, that's not where I would sing that Leanne Rimes song, how do I live without you? How do I breathe without you? And my dad would be like, you don't need a man. And that's coming from like a traditional Christian household.
The song that always killed me hearing girls sing was Crash by a Dave Matthews Band.
Oh, yeah. And or like, Hit Me what? Baby, Hit Me Baby One More Time. Yeah, so I don't, but those songs can be like disrespectful and damaging. I think that when I'm listening to this song, it's just a sweet love song.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just all about teaching girls to find the right person. Yeah. Someone that they can trust to lead.
So we are coming to a close on Women's History Month.
Yeah. Our older son was like, my teacher's really into Women's History Month. We've been reading a lot of woman books. I'm like, all right, well, you know. Enjoy. But to a 7-year-old, you know, Women's History Month is not like super exciting. I don't think he has anything against women per se, but
well, in the spirit of Women's History Month, what notes do you have? What do you think this should be cataloged into Women's History?
Oh, absolutely. She's got to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah, she is. Oh, yeah,
no. No, this is peak women's history. This is a woman with incredible talent, incredible gifts, using those for other people. I'm sure she was paid handsomely to do so, to write songs for other people, but then also performing them herself with incredible power and grace and simultaneously raising daughters. I think she has... I mean, with her first marriage, she had the two daughters, and a lot of these songs she wrote with a baby on her hip in her artistic commune. I don't think she had a nanny, and was, you know, she did the mom thing, and she loved raising her girls and still pursuing her dreams. So this is like very solid Women's History Month stuff. What if I'd been like, eh? Women's History Month.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is pretty significant and should be noted as a big example of women's history, groundbreaking women's history, at least if not all of women's history. I mean, she didn't help get women the right to vote. But when you're talking about music and art, this is one of, I think, the biggest artist, one of the biggest, most important albums in women's history, because one, her storyline. So she was behind the scenes for 10 years. Kind of like, I think your Phyllis analogy is a good one, because Phyllis also on The Office felt like nervous and felt like she couldn't maybe have the chops to act with someone like Steve Carell. But then hear an interview that Steve Carell was always like, Phyllis was the one that I always look at because she was like always in character or always down. So I think that Carole King kind of had that stage fright early on, didn't want to take the spotlight, and maybe getting some mentorship from someone like James Taylor was really important. But then when Tapestry came out, this sat on the charts for 15 consecutive weeks. It's unreal. It held the record for most non-consecutive weeks at number one by a female solo artist for over 20 years.
So it was at number one on and off for 20 years. It's non-consecutively.
Yeah, I don't know.
And then it was 15 consecutive weeks at number one on the Billboard.
It just charts. Held.
And then this one says it did hold that record for non-consecutive weeks. So that means someone might have bumped her, but then she came back.
Yeah. I think actually at one point James Taylor bumped her with her own song that she wrote.
She was probably like, good for you. Good for you. And she knitted him a sweater.
So on top of that, first woman to win Song of the Year and first solo woman to win Record of the Year.
Good for her. Yeah. If you want to file that under women making history, I think that would be fair, fair to do.
So I think that one's noteworthy. Okay. Well, let's wrap it up with favorite track on the album.
Oh gosh, Sean, that is really, really difficult. Oh no, like what one could I not live without? You have to go first while I look at that.
I want you to also guess what you think my favorite track would be.
Oh shoot. I mean,
because it is hard. It is kind of
lyrically, so many of these songs are so important to me. I identify with so many of them. Even though that's kind of an overwrought thing to say. Oh, sheesh. If I had to pick one that this album would be incomplete without, it would be I Feel the Earth Move. But my personal favorite is Beautiful. What about you?
Are you a good guess?
Oh, I'm supposed to guess. And then if I get it wrong, it shows that there's a problem with our relationship.
This is the newlywed game.
Is it... Oh, Sean. Where you lead? Is it I Feel the Earth Move?
So it's close. That one is close. I think I would actually be with you, and I think I would go with Beautiful.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. We should get matching tattoos with some of the lyrics. Do you ever tell your listeners what our first dance song was for our wedding?
That topic has not come up in the 17th. I guess this is our 18th episode. This is our
18th episode.
So
it's going to be a mystery for another day.
You don't want to share? Close us out.
Okay, so the first... The song for our first dance or our wedding, it's the year is 2010. We are 22 and 24 years old. And our first dance song was Billy Joel's Just the Way You Are. So I can guarantee you that we were the only 22 and 24 year olds getting married in the teens or the aughts of 2000.
Yeah.
Did that song.
Speaking of other sweet sax solos.
Yeah. I think we cut it right before the sax solo.
We faded out the sax solo because it's a long song and we didn't want to be dancing in front of people for that long.
For our wedding, the DJ we hired was hired to strictly play Sean's playlist. And there was also like, on top of only play these songs, there was a list of never play these songs, which was like what, the Cha-Cha Slide, the YMCA, anything like that. So Sean had like a detailed schedule of when you play each song, and these songs are for dinner, these songs are for this time. It was You could definitely tell that that's that and the cake were what he put his heart and soul into. That and the cake tasting.
The cake tasting was choice.
Yeah. It was, I knew that you would enjoy that part, so I made sure that that fit into your schedule. And then we had a lot of frozen wedding cake that we ate pretty much every night for a good long time. We were so young when we got married that we just ate defrosted cake and played Wii every night for the first like year of our marriage.
I do have one last question that I want to ask you about this record, because I want to know what your feelings are about this. Mm-hmm. And I think it fits at the end. So Where You Lead uses the technique to end the song of just the gradual fade out. What is your take on the gradual fade
out? I mean, I'm fine with it in this context, but I'd be fine never hearing it again from another artist. Because, I mean, I listened to a lot of Christian contemporary music in the 90s, because that's what was, you know, kind of allowed around the house besides some of these classics. And those were aggressive with the gradual fade out. And so to me, it's just like very dated. I'm like, end it or don't end it, but don't like fiddle faddle.
Every time that I hear the gradual fade out, I was like, what are you going to do live, man?
They just like slowly close the curtain.
Just like slowly inch back.
I was like, this is really awkward. Just dim the lights. Yeah, I mean, it's not my favorite, but she can do no wrong. So fine. If that's what she felt was the appropriate choice, who am I to judge? Are you going to fade out this episode?
Yeah, I was. I'll do that. I was like, gradually, we're just going to keep talking.
Lower our voices.
Just start inching my chair back away from the microphone. Well, it's been great talking about this record. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Well, please make sure to follow us on your favorite podcasting platform and give us a follow on Instagram. And then until next time, I'm Sean, and this is Album Worms.